A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. And honestly, it's the kind of prompt that lands like a punch to the gut if you've ever rented. He's moved 6 times in 10 years. His last lease ended because the landlord gave the apartment to his daughter as a gift. Not eviction for cause. Not a rent hike. Just, here you go, sweetie. Happy birthday. Now the tenants can figure out where to live.
The daughter gift eviction. I've seen that exact move 3 times in my old practice. Parents transfer an apartment to a kid, kid wants to move in, and suddenly a family that's been paying rent faithfully for years has 30 days to vanish. Perfectly legal under tenancy at will.
The prompt asks something that I think a lot of people feel, but don't quite name. Is there a way to be settled, actually comfortable, actually at home, but also move ready? Organized enough that if the lease ends unexpectedly, you're not starting from zero. He set up a home inventory system the day he moved into the new place. His rationale was knowing where everything is and what they own makes it easier to manage what he calls a minimal viable store of goods. But he's asking what else you can do, physically and bureaucratically, to make unexpected moves less catastrophic.
This is the right question at the right time. The Israel Democracy Institute put out a survey last year. 68% of renters aged 25 to 40 have moved at least 3 times in the past decade. 3 moves is the floor. The average is closer to every 2 to 3 years. And that's not a preference. That's a market structure.
Tenancy at will is still the default for any rental contract under 5 years here. Either party can terminate with 30 to 60 days notice for any reason or no reason. The landlord doesn't need to prove anything. You don't get a hearing. You get a letter.
The cost of being caught off guard is real. Moving within the same city for a 3-room apartment runs between 2,500 and 5,000 shekels, and that's just the movers and boxes and utility reconnection fees. It doesn't count the day you take off work, the things that break, the overlap rent, if the dates don't line up perfectly.
Or the sanity. The sanity is a line item that doesn't appear on any invoice, but you definitely pay it.
The prompt is essentially asking, what does a system look like that treats moving not as a once every few years catastrophe, but as a background process you're always partially ready for? Not living out of boxes, not being a minimalist for the sake of it, not prepping for doomsday, but having your physical stuff, your paperwork, and your head organized so that a 30-day notice is painful but not paralyzing.
I think there's something almost philosophically honest about this approach. The rental market tells you, explicitly, that your home is provisional. The landlord can give it to his daughter. The owner can decide to sell. You're not imagining the instability. So the question becomes, do you pretend that's not true and get blindsided every time? Or do you build a life that acknowledges it and keeps you functional anyway?
That's the core tension, settled but move ready. It sounds like a contradiction, but I think it's actually a coherent philosophy once you break it down. And the prompt gives us a really concrete starting point, the home inventory system, the minimal viable store of goods that we can build outward from.
Let's do that. Let's talk about what this actually looks like room by room, box by box, and form by form. Because the physical stuff is only one layer. The bureaucratic overhead in Israel is its own special circle of administrative torment.
Oh, the utility transfer alone. We'll get there. But first, I want to define the 3 pillars this whole approach rests on: physical inventory and packing strategy, bureaucratic utility and address management, and psychological readiness, which is really about letting go of the illusion that your rental is permanent and making peace with that without becoming numb.
The illusion of permanence is the thing that makes every move feel like a betrayal. You paint a wall, you hang a shelf, you plant something on the balcony, and part of you thinks, this is mine now, I live here. And the system says, no, you're just borrowing it until the daughter needs it.
Or until the owner's son finishes the army. Or until they can get 20% more from the next tenant. The reasons don't matter. What matters is whether you're ready, and the prompt is asking for a practical guide to being ready. So let's build one. Let's start with the physical layer, because that's what most people think of first when they hear move-ready. But the mistake is assuming it means living like a monk. It doesn't. The goal is that your home feels fully lived in day to day, but when the notice arrives, you're not staring at 10 years of accumulated chaos wondering where to even begin.
The distinction from minimalism is worth nailing down. Minimalism says own less because less is better. Move ready says own what you actually use and enjoy, but know exactly what you have, where it is, and how it fits into a packing sequence. It's not an aesthetic. It's an information system.
It's also not prepping. Prepping is about stockpiling for disaster scenarios. This is about not letting a perfectly legal 30-day notice turn into a disaster in the first place. The disaster isn't hypothetical. It happened to the neighbor. It happened to the prompt. It's happening to someone listening right now.
The daughter gift situation is almost a perfect case study because it's so arbitrary. Nobody did anything wrong. The rent was paid. The place was cared for. The relationship with the landlord was presumably fine. And still, the apartment is gone. That's the emotional gut punch that the system is designed to deliver. The question is whether you've built enough scaffolding around your life that the punch lands but doesn't knock you over.
Scaffolding is the right metaphor. You're not building a bunker. You're building something that holds you up while you transition. So when we talk about a home inventory system, we're not talking about cataloging every spoon for insurance purposes. We're talking about knowing what you own in a way that lets you make fast decisions. What goes in the first wave? What can wait? What can you leave behind if you have to?
That's where the minimal viable store of goods concept gets practical. If you had 48 hours to pack and 2 weeks before you could access the rest of your stuff, what do you absolutely need? The answer is probably smaller than you think. One pot, one pan, one good knife, 4 plates, 4 sets of cutlery, 2 weeks of clothes, 1 set of sheets, toiletries in a single bag. Everything else is second wave.
Here's the thing, you don't have to live with only those items. That's the misconception. You could have your full kitchen, your full wardrobe, your bookshelves, and your plants. But you've identified the core, you know which box it goes in. You've tagged it in your inventory. When the notice comes, you're not making those decisions under duress. You made them on a Sunday afternoon, 6 months ago, when your brain was calm.
The duress is what makes moving expensive in ways that don't show up on the invoice. You make bad decisions. You throw things in garbage bags. You lose stuff and have to replace it. The inventory system is essentially a way to pre-make decisions, so the stressed version of you doesn't have to.
That's the first pillar in practice. Physical readiness isn't about deprivation. It's about having already answered the question, what matters most, before anyone forces you to answer it. Let's get specific. The inventory system that actually works, and I've looked at a few, is digital, visual, and tagged, not a mental list, not a notebook you'll lose. I'm talking about a spreadsheet at minimum, or something like Sortly if you want an app that handles photos and QR codes. Every item or group of items gets a photo, an estimated replacement value, and most importantly, a packing group tag.
Packing group tag. That's the part most people skip.
It's the part that saves you when you're panicking. The tags are simple. Kitchen daily means this item is in your minimal viable store. It goes in the first wave. Kitchen seldom means the waffle iron you use twice a year. It goes in the second wave. Bedroom linens is its own category because linens are bulky and you need to know exactly how many sets you have when you're deciding what fits in the truck.
You're not just cataloging. You're pre-assigning every object to priority level for a move that hasn't happened yet.
The value column does double duty. It's not just for insurance. It's for sanity checking during a move. If you're looking at a box tag kitchen seldom with a total value of 200 shekels and the moving truck is full, you can make a fast call, leave it, donate it, replace it later. That decision takes 30 seconds instead of 30 minutes of agonizing.
The agonizing is what kills you. I've watched people spend 20 minutes debating whether to keep a half-broken vegetable peeler because they were too exhausted to think clearly.
That connects to the case study I want to mention. A couple in Tel Aviv, 3-room apartment, 2 kids, got a 14-day eviction notice for owner occupancy. They had been using this exact inventory system for about 8 months. Photos, tags, the whole thing. They packed their entire apartment in 6 hours, and they were sleeping in the new place that same evening.
6 hours for a 3-room apartment with kids.
Because they didn't have to think. They printed the inventory, sorted by packing group, and worked through it. The first night box was already packed and waiting. The movers arrived. The boxes were color-coded. Red for essentials, blue for daily use, green for storage, and the movers knew exactly which boxes went to which room in the new place because the labels told them.
Let's talk about those boxes, because the standardization matters. You mentioned banker's boxes, the 18 by 18 by 24 inch size.
That size is deliberate. It's large enough to hold meaningful amounts, but small enough that one person can carry it fully loaded without destroying their back. It stacks uniformly in a truck. You could buy them in bulk, and they all fit the same lids. The chaos of moving is partly chaos of geometry. Mismatched boxes, random bags, that one weirdly shaped lamp that doesn't fit anywhere. Standardizing the container eliminates a whole category of friction.
The color coding. Red, blue, green.
Red is essentials. Open first at the new place. That's your first night box, your minimal viable kitchen, your 2 weeks of clothes. Blue is daily use, the stuff you use regularly but can survive without for a day or two. Green is seasonal and storage. The winter coats in July, the holiday decorations, the extra linens. The movers don't need to understand your life. They just need to know red goes to the bedroom and kitchen first, blue goes to the living area, green can go to the storage corner.
The first night box deserves its own moment. You said it never gets fully unpacked.
And this is the psychological shift that makes the whole system work. The first night box contains toilet paper, a kettle, a mug, a towel, a phone charger, and a change of clothes. It lives in the bottom of your closet or under your bed. You don't raid it for the kettle when your main one breaks. You replace the main one. The first night box is sacrosanct. It's your insurance policy against the worst moving day scenario, which is arriving at the new place at 10 p.m., exhausted, surrounded by boxes, and realizing you can't make tea or charge your phone or take a shower.
That specific misery. Standing in an empty apartment with no toilet paper and a dead phone is the distilled essence of why people dread moving, and you can prevent it permanently for about 200 shekels and a plastic tub.
The box never gets unpacked because the next move is always coming. That's not pessimism. That's the statistical reality for 68% of renters in this country. The first night box is just acknowledging the math.
Which brings us to the volume problem. You can have the best labeling system in the world, but if you've accumulated enough stuff to fill two moving trucks, you're still in trouble. That's where the one box in, one box out rule comes in.
This is the simplest rule and the hardest to follow. Every time you acquire something non-consumable, a new lamp, a new set of sheets, a new kitchen gadget, something of equivalent volume has to leave your inventory. You donate it, you sell it, you give it to a friend, but it exits your home. The goal isn't minimalism. The goal is steady state volume. Your total possession should fit in a single moving truck always.
The trick is that it's volume-based, not item count-based. You don't have to agonize over whether a new book is worth keeping. You just have to make space for it by removing something of similar size. The decision becomes mechanical, not emotional.
Mechanical decisions are what you want when the alternative is emotional decisions made under time pressure. The rule also forces a kind of ongoing curation that prevents the slow creep of stuff that happens when you live somewhere for more than a year. You know the phenomenon, the drawer of mystery cables. The box of, I might need this someday, that you haven't opened since two apartments ago.
The cable drawer is the rental market's silent accomplice. It multiplies in the dark while you're not looking.
It's always the heaviest box. Which brings me to the question a lot of people ask at this point, doesn't this system make you obsessive? If you're photographing everything you own and tagging it and measuring volume, aren't you just thinking about moving all the time?
That's the tension. The prompt is asking for settled but move-ready, and the system we're describing sounds like it tilts hard toward move-ready. How do you maintain it without your home feeling like a warehouse with a departure schedule?
I think the answer is that the system is front-loaded. You do the work once, the inventory, the photos, the tags, the first night box, and then you maintain it in tiny increments. 5 minutes when you buy something new. 10 minutes every few months to update photos if something changes. The goal is that 98% of the time, you don't think about moving at all. Your home feels like a home. The system is dormant. It only activates when you need it.
Like a fire extinguisher. You don't stare at it every day wondering when the fire will come. You just know it's there.
The one box in, one box out rule actually makes your home more pleasant to live in, not less. Clutter is stressful regardless of whether you're moving. Keeping your total volume steady means your space stays functional. You're not tripping over things. You can find what you need. That's a quality of life improvement even if you never move again.
What about sentimental items?
That's the question that always comes up. The sentimental stuff. The box of letters from your grandmother. The kid's first shoes. The pottery you made on that trip. Does it count against the volume budget?
I think the honest answer is yes, but it gets a different category. It's not kitchen seldom. It's not seasonal. It's core identity stuff. And the move-ready approach doesn't say get rid of it. It says know exactly how much of it you have, pack it with care, and accept that it takes up space that something else can't.
That's where the one-box-in, one-box-out rule gets a carve-out. Sentimental items are exempt from forced turnover. You don't have to throw out your grandfather's watch because you bought a new lamp, but you do have to account for the volume. If your sentimental items fill three banker's boxes, that's three boxes that are permanently in your moving calculation. You don't get surprised by them on moving day.
The surprise is the enemy. That's the thread running through the whole physical system. Surprise volume, surprise weight, surprise. I forgot we owned a kayak. Now let's talk about the layer that actually makes people cry, which is not the boxes. It's the bureaucracy.
Oh, this is where it gets genuinely grim. The physical stuff we've covered, it's work, but it's straightforward. The Israeli utility disconnection and reconnection process is a labyrinth designed by people who apparently never had to use it themselves.
The prompt mentions this specifically. Tenants disconnect utilities and reconnect them, and the overhead is brutal. Each utility is its own fiefdom. Separate forms, separate phone numbers, separate lead times, and a lot of it is in Hebrew with no English fallback.
Let's walk through the actual landscape. Electricity is the Israel Electric Company, the IEC. They require 48 hours notice for disconnection, and the reconnection fee is about 150 shekels during business hours. Double that if you need it after hours or on a Friday. And here's the trap. If you forget to disconnect and the next tenant starts using electricity in your name, you're on the hook until you sort it out. That can take weeks.
Water is sometimes the landlord's responsibility, sometimes not. Gas. If you have individual gas tanks, that's straightforward. But if you're on central gas, you're dealing with another company entirely. Internet is its own special nightmare because the lead times don't match. You can disconnect electricity in 2 days. Internet might take 2 weeks to transfer if you want to keep the same provider.
The prompt's experience, moving 6 times in 10 years, means doing this dance 6 times. Each time with different providers, different account numbers, different hold music. The average person loses at least one full working day just on phone calls and form submissions per move.
What's the system? You mentioned a utility transfer kit.
The utility transfer kit is a folder, physical and digital, that you assemble once and update when things change. It contains your current account numbers for every utility, meter readings from the day you moved in, a template cancellation letter in Hebrew, and a checklist of which utilities require 48 hours notice versus 7 days notice. Crucially, it also includes the phone numbers and extensions for actual humans who answer, not the general customer service line, the specific person who processed your last move.
How do you get that extension?
You ask for it when you finally reach someone. Write it down. Put it in the kit. Next time, you skip the queue. This is the kind of institutional knowledge that renters accumulate through pain and rarely share.
The template cancellation letter in Hebrew. That's the thing that saves you if you don't speak the language well enough.
The prompt didn't specify language level, but a lot of people renting in Israel are not native Hebrew speakers. The utility companies don't care. The forms are in Hebrew. The phone trees are in Hebrew. If you show up with a pre-written cancellation letter that a Hebrew-speaking friend helped you draft once, you just change the date and the address and send it again. You're not starting from zero every time.
I want to talk about the case study you mentioned earlier. The listener in Jerusalem who used the utility transfer kit to switch apartments in 3 days, including internet.
This is someone who had been through the process enough times to build the kit. They had the cancellation letter pre-signed. They had the new address pre-registered with the IEC. When the notice came, they made 3 phone calls. Electricity, water, internet, and each call took under 10 minutes because they had the account numbers and the extension for the person who could actually process the request. The internet transfer, which normally takes 2 weeks, got done in 3 days because they called the retention department directly instead of going through general customer service. Retention departments move faster. They want to keep you as a customer at the new address.
That's a hack worth underlining. The retention department has better service than the new customer department.
Every telecom company works this way. The people who cancel accounts get routed to the team that's authorized to solve problems quickly.
The utility transfer kit handles electricity, water, gas, internet. But the address change bureaucracy goes deeper than utilities. There's a whole government layer.
This is where the Israeli system is particularly fragmented. There is no single address change portal. Germany has the Anmeldung system. You register your address within 14 days or you face fines. It's centralized. Israel technically requires address updates too, but enforcement is lax, and that laxness is actually a trap.
How is lax enforcement a trap?
Because when it matters suddenly and expensively. You forget to update your address with Bituak Lumi, the National Insurance Institute. 6 months later, they send a registered letter about a benefits adjustment to your old apartment. You don't receive it. They assume you're ignoring them. Now you have a fine or a frozen account, and you didn't even know there was a problem.
The lack of enforcement creates a false sense of security. Nothing happens for years, and then something happens all at once.
The list of agencies that need your new address is longer than most people realize. The Interior Ministry for your Tudat Zehut, your ID card, your Kupat Olam, the health fund, and the Municipality for Arnona, the property tax. That's 6 separate entities, each with their own process, and none of them talk to each other.
The municipality is the one that bites people. Arnona bills keep going to the old address. The new tenant throws them out. And suddenly, you have a debt you didn't know about.
Arnona debt accrues interest. It's not a friendly system. So the move-ready approach to this is what I'd call a digital mailroom. You set up a dedicated email folder for all rental-related correspondence. Every utility bill, every lease document, every communication with a landlord. And you get a physical P.O. box or use a trusted friend's address as your permanent mailing address for anything government-related.
The friend's address is an underrated strategy. Your rental address changes every 2 years. Your friend who owns an apartment has the same address for a decade. Route the important mail there.
It prevents the nightmare scenario of missing a registered letter about a court date or a utility disconnection because you already moved. The Postal Service doesn't forward registered mail reliably here. If it goes to the old address, you might never see it.
Which brings us to the psychological layer. We've covered stuff, we've covered forms, but there's a document that sits at the intersection of both, and it's something I think every renter should maintain, a rental resume.
This is a document that serves 2 purposes, and both of them save you. It's your rental history, addresses, landlord names, dates, deposit amounts, and photos of move-in condition for every place you've lived. When you apply for the next apartment, you're not scrambling to remember your previous landlord's phone number from 4 years ago. You hand over a clean one-pager that makes you look like the kind of tenant who has their act together.
The second purpose is deposit disputes. The photos of move-in condition are evidence. If the landlord claims you damaged something that was already damaged, you're not arguing from memory. You have a timestamp photo from the day you moved in.
The rental resume is the document that says, I am not a victim of the system, I am a professional participant in it. And that shift in posture matters psychologically. You're not just bracing for the next disaster. You're maintaining a record that gives you leverage.
Which is where the landlord blacklist comes in, though I'd call it something gentler in public. A private document for your own use. Landlords who pulled the daughter gift move. Landlords who withheld deposits without cause. Landlords who ignored maintenance requests until the ceiling literally fell in. You don't publish it, but you keep it, and you consult it before signing the next lease.
That's the psychological pillar in practice. It's not about becoming cynical. It's about accepting that the system treats you as provisional and responding by building your own continuity. Your rental resume, your utility kit, your inventory. These are things that persist across addresses. They're your real home in a sense. The apartment is just where they're currently deployed.
That's almost comforting. The stuff and the paperwork travel with you. The walls don't.
If you've done the work, the move itself becomes mechanical rather than existential. You're not losing your home. You're relocating your system. That reframe sounds small, but I've seen it change how people handle the 30-day notice. Less panic, more checklist.
Let's bring this down to what someone can actually do. We've described a lot of systems. The prompt is asking for practical steps. If a listener is sitting in their rental right now, maybe with a lease that feels shaky, what's the first thing they should do this weekend?
The first night box. It's the single highest leverage action we've talked about. It costs nothing. You already own a kettle and a towel and a phone charger. You just need a plastic tub or a sturdy box. Assemble it this Saturday. Toilet paper, kettle, mug, towel, charger, change of clothes. Put it somewhere accessible. You've just bought yourself peace of mind for the cost of 15 minutes.
The psychological effect is immediate. You know that no matter what happens, you will not be standing in an empty apartment with a dead phone and no way to make tea. That specific scenario is now off the table forever.
Second actionable step, the utility transfer checklist. Don't wait until you need it. Open your current bills this week. Electricity, water, gas, internet, Arnona, and write down every account number. Put them in a document, save it in the cloud. Print a copy and put it in a folder. If you don't speak Hebrew well enough to draft the cancellation letter yourself, ask a friend now while you're not under time pressure. The letter just needs to say, I, name, ID number, am terminating service at address X effective date. Y. Change the details each time. You're done.
The cloud copy is the part people skip. If you only have the physical folder, and you're not home when the notice arrives, or if the folder gets packed in the wrong box, you're back to square one. The cloud copy is accessible from anywhere, including the new apartment before the internet is connected.
Third, the one box in, one box out rule. Commit to it for 90 days. That's a manageable window. Every non-consumable thing you bring in, something of equivalent volume goes out. At the end of 90 days, take stock. The goal is to reduce your total possessions by 20% without buying anything new. Not because you're becoming a minimalist, because you're making space for the next move before it's urgent.
20% is a number that sounds aggressive, but it's usually just the stuff you don't use. The cable drawer. The clothes you haven't worn since 2 apartments ago. The kitchen gadgets that seemed essential at the time. You're not depriving yourself. You're excavating.
If you do all three, first night box this weekend, utility checklist this week, one box in, one box out for 90 days, you've gone from move vulnerable to move. Ready without spending more than maybe 100 shekels on a plastic tub and some folders.
The last thing I'd add is not a system. It's an invitation. The prompt came from one renter's experience, but the collective wisdom on this topic is enormous. Every person who's moved 6 times in 10 years has discovered something that works. A hack for getting the internet transferred faster. A moving company that doesn't overcharge. A phrase to include in a lease that gives you an extra 2 weeks' notice. Share that stuff. The subreddit. The Discord. That's where the real institutional knowledge lives.
Individual expertise tops out fast. But a community of people who've all been through the daughter gift eviction or the owner occupancy notice? That's a research department no single expert can match. Here's the question that sits underneath all of this. Are we describing a coping mechanism for a broken system? Or is this actually a better way to live regardless?
That's the tension. On one hand, none of this would be necessary if the rental market weren't rigged to treat tenants as temporary occupants with no rights to stability. The daughter gift eviction shouldn't be legal. Tenancy at will shouldn't be the default. We're building systems to protect ourselves from something that shouldn't exist in the first place.
The ability to move quickly, to relocate without chaos, to have your life organized in a way that's portable, that's not just a defensive posture. It's a kind of freedom. Remote work is decoupling people from geographic anchors. The idea that you live in one place for 30 years and retire there is already a historical artifact for a huge portion of the population.
Maybe move ready isn't a concession to a broken market. Maybe it's a skill set that the next generation will need regardless of whether they rent or own. The question isn't whether you move. The question is whether moving destroys your week or just rearranges your coordinates.
That reframe changes the emotional valence of the whole thing. You're not bracing for disaster. You're maintaining a kind of agility that lets you say yes to opportunities. A job in another city, a year abroad, a better apartment that opens up suddenly. The same system that protects you from the daughter gift eviction also makes you the person who can pounce on the perfect place when it appears.
The flip side, though, and I think this is the part we can't dodge, is what happens to community when everyone is move-ready. If you know you'll probably leave in 18 months, do you join the neighborhood council? Do you invest in relationships with the shopkeepers? Do you plant anything that takes more than a season to grow?
That's the open wound in the whole rental economy. The transient tenant is rational to stay disengaged. Why bother getting to know neighbors who'll just become another address on your rental resume? But the aggregate effect is neighborhoods where nobody knows anybody, where local businesses lose their regulars, where the concept of home gets thinner every year.
That's the episode we're doing next, apparently. The emotional cost of serial renting. How to build community when you know you'll leave. I think that's going to be the harder conversation, honestly. The boxes and the forms are solvable. The loneliness is trickier.
But I think the move-ready mindset, done right, actually creates space for community rather than foreclosing it. When you're not panicking about your next move, you have bandwidth for other things. You can show up for your neighbors because you're not drowning in administrative chaos. The system buys you presence.
Presence is the thing that scares. The rental market wants you distracted and exhausted. Move-ready is how you refuse that.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, a prospector in the Yukon reported that a platypus could detect the electrical signal of a single muscle twitch in a shrimp from half an inch away, which, scaled to human proportions, would be like sensing a flashlight flicker from the top of Mount Logan while standing in Whitehorse.
Right. If you found this useful, rate the podcast 5 stars and tell a friend who just got an eviction notice. Next episode, we're tackling the emotional cost of serial renting. How to build community when you know you'll leave in 18 months. That one's going to hurt. But I think we owe it to the prompt.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. We're at My Weird Prompts.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.